You're listening to audio from the Cathedral Church of the Advent in Birmingham, Alabama, a church with a heart for the gospel. Find out more at adventbirmingham.org.
Lord, thank you for the families that you've given us. Thank you for our kids, for all the blessings that they are, for the blessings of athletics, the blessings of sport. And I pray that you would come to us now, that we might learn from you. Pray that your word speak this morning and that we would hear them. Pray this all in Christ's name. Amen. Amen. All right, so I've titled this, the title of this talk this morning and the next week's class is Biblical Ways to Get Your Kids Better at Sports. And today, so today's the first of a two-part class. Show of hands, who has one child that plays competitive sports? Okay. Who has more than one that plays competitive sports? Okay. Raise your hand if, to some degree, at some seasonal aspect, sports and extracurricular activities have taken over your life. Okay. I thought that might be the case. So there are two main points that I want to hang these classes on, and I don't think that we're going to solve society's infatuation with competitive sports and the round-the-clock nature of it. I think we're going to solve that today or next week. But what I want to give you all are just ways of looking at it, maybe ways that we might be able to collectively take a step back and to see what are the forces and dynamics at play that really impact our kids that are playing competitive sports. Because they are. They really exist, and talk about that. So there are two points that I would love that I'm going to hang these classes on are the first thesis that I have is, or the first just point I want to make is the basics of the Christian faith, which includes the doctrine of sin, the doctrine of the law, and then the gospel impact every part of your life. They impact every part of your life, and they impact every part of your kids' lives, and that includes athletics. Today, we're just going to talk about sin. So the doctrine of sin, I'll say for today, impacts every part of your life and every part of your kids' lives. And then my second thesis is that any athlete, whatever the age, plays better in an in-game competition relative to their proven ability. That's a key part of what I want to suggest. They play better relative to their proven ability when they are loose, when they are free, and when they, at some practically recognizable level, are having fun. So those are my two theses. We're going to talk about these, but I'd like to start off with a couple of helpful statistics that are going to contextualize our class. For instance, did you know that 11% of parents think that their child can play professional sports? So that's 1 in 10. I would ask for a show of hands, but I don't want to embarrass anybody. That's the size of this room. 1 in 10 believe that their child has the ability to play professional sports. I would love to know the data on how many young athletes believe they can play professional sports. It's probably more like 9 in 10 or 10 in 10. But 11% of parents believe that their children has the ability to play professional sports. So I'd like to compare that to some data published by the NCAA. So according to the NCAA, the governing body of collegiate athletics, NCAA statistics show that only a minuscule of high school, so that's athletes that have made varsity level sports, a minuscule amount of high school athletes will play professional sports. So one in basically 10,400 high school basketball players will be picked on an NBA team. Has there ever been a player from Mountain Brook or Vestavia playing the NBA? Okay. I know I'm trying to think. Trendon Watford did. Christian Watford played for a bit. Jordan Swing has played some, but it's minuscule. It's like one in a zillion. One in 12,800 will be of female high school basketball players will be chosen for an NBA, a WNBA team. One in about 4,000 will get picked by an NFL team. And then one, this statistic is a little bit misleading, so I'll clarify it for a bit. One in 610 will be drafted by a Major League Baseball team. Now, that does not include, that includes all the minor leagues, which are thousands and thousands of baseball players. So really only 5 to 6% of drafted players will ever make it to the major leagues. So 1 in 20 will ever actually make it to the major leagues, which, so that means 0.0008% of high school baseball players will play Major League Baseball. So that's about 1 in 10,000 high school baseball players will play Major League Baseball. I know of exactly, I played high school baseball in Birmingham. I know of exactly one guy out of all the varsity baseball players in Birmingham from when I was playing that played on a major league roster, and he was on again, off again, on again, off again, on again, off again. I know of like really three sort of in the generations kind of around me in a 1.2 million metro area that played Major League Baseball. So if our kids are not going pro in athletics, and I've called this class How to Get Your Kids Better at Sports, why have this class at all? There's really three things that I want to talk about with you all this week and next week. The first is this. The first is that I want your children to grow up loving athletics. I know you want your children to grow up loving athletics, but I want your children to grow up loving athletics. That's why I wanted to do this class in the first place. But the second reason is that loving athletics, or the point of this class, loving your sport, becomes difficult at different times in different junctures than it otherwise would be when you grow up in a performance identity culture. So performance identity culture. A performance identity culture suggests that one's value is based on the quality of their result, of their performance. Does that resonate with anyone here? So for instance, just a show of hands, has a statement like this ever landed kind of with your life and area? Sometimes my child gets really nervous before a game because they're afraid they're going to play bad. Does that resonate? Sometimes my child gets really nervous before a test because they're afraid that they're going to fail. Sometimes my child gets really nervous in social situations because they're afraid they won't be cool enough. So this is what life in a performance identity culture looks like, which is nothing new, by the way. It's not like we invented this in the 21st century in the Birmingham metro area, but we do live in one. So what I'm going to suggest today, that there are not only sociological reasons behind that, but there are actually real theological reasons behind that that are really thick with significance. And there's also a theological answer to it, which we're going to scratch on today. But I'm mainly kind of setting up these things for us to just see. But the third reason why I have this class is that, relative to their ability, I think that your children are going to play better when they're having fun. I think they're going to enjoy themselves more. I think they're going to play better when they're having fun. There's a couple of presuppositions, obviously, that go here. Talent matters. Like how good your kid is actually matters, which I always say relative to their performance or relative to their ability. Practicing matters. Like how much they practice something matters. We want them to practice because they love it, because they love a sport, not because they feel like they have to in order to kind of keep up the standards or jobs. What I'm going to talk about here, what I'm talking about here is kids who have the ability. The main dynamic that I want us to think about is kids that play well at something in the backyard or play well at something in practice, but in the in-game results, it might mean too much to them. They might get too nervous about it, and they perform worse because they're really nervous and tight. Does that make sense? Do y'all resonate with that? So what do I base this, all of my claims upon? What do I base them upon? The first is this. As the thesis says, the basic teaching of the Christian faith, which includes the doctrine of sin, the law, and the gospel, impact every part of our lives and our children's lives, and that includes athletics. We'll get to those in a minute. Really, what do I base these on? There's really three things that I'm kind of basing the idea of this class upon that when it first came to me. The first of this is it came to me via personal experience. I was a high school baseball pitcher, and I started at a 6A school in Birmingham, which means that I was okay to be a starting pitcher at a 6A school in Birmingham. And I briefly played in college. And I am, hence my briefness in college, was known as a flame out. Like, fully just totally flamed out playing in college. I stopped playing because of sheer burnout and as a result of some of the negative dynamics of the above, and we'll talk about more. But I'm also a present-day golfer, which doesn't mean much except for I'm just a competitor and I love golf. And I'm not a serious golfer, but I'm somewhat capable. And I've noticed, and in hindsight, looking back on my baseball life, that I not only just enjoy myself more when I play a sport for the love of it, I mean, that's just basic, but oddly enough, I play better. I play better when I'm just enjoying it and I'm loving the game for itself. And in hindsight, I can look back on a handful of performances in baseball where my best pitching performances occurred when for whatever reason I dropped the notion of I have to play well and perform well or else. There's like I have to play well today. And my mindset shifted to, why don't we just enjoy ourselves today, see the mitt, hit the mitt, one batter at a time, get into a rhythm, and let's see what happens. The real notion here is it's paradoxical effort. The less hard I try at something, actually, the better it comes to me. There's a couple of things that this really sinks into in different aspects of our lives. One is learning. The less hard we're trying to like take in information, sometimes we actually learn the information better if we're just kind of sitting in and taking it in, and we remember it. It's just like our recall happens, as opposed to like I really have to try really, really, really hard to memorize all of this. We're in that instance, we're focusing more on trying hard to learn something rather than just learning something naturally. The second thing happens, this is just a fun dynamic, is sleep. Have y'all ever tried really, 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 really hard to fall asleep? And then 2 hours later, you're trying really, 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 really hard to sleep. Sometimes things just naturally come to us. And like that's paradoxical effort. That's a blessed aside. But I think it makes a lot of sense here. But the second basis that I have this on this claim is also having spent time in a collegiate baseball dugout for 4 years. I was a chaplain for the Birmingham Southern baseball team for 4 years. And I began to notice that it's dynamic as well, spending 4 years with that baseball team. And generally speaking, the guys enjoyed themselves and they played better when they didn't exist under a ball of pressure. Now, I saw that. I began to kind of theorize this, and I saw it happen outside of me, which made me think there must be something here. And again, I'm not saying that they weren't competitive. Concerning my previous claim, I'm going to say I'm not competitive. But at the same time, I've seen how athletics and even youth sports can become emotionally challenging and psychologically challenging and spiritually challenging because of the pressure we put ourselves under. So the third claim that I have really on this whole project is I have found the basic tenets of the Christian faith have a lot to offer in this area. Just basic principles of the Christian faith have a lot to offer in this area. So what are we going to talk about today and next week? We're going to talk about the intersectionality of Christianity and athletics. And we're going to talk about how, as you as parents, can support your children in their athletic journey in ways that I think will help your kids enjoy their sport throughout their athletic journey. Does that sound fun? Okay, good. I want it to be fun. Or at least practically good for your lives. Okay, so again, back to these theses. I believe the basic teaching of the Christian faith, which includes the doctrine of sin, the law and the gospel, impact every part of our lives, including athletics. So the first, what do I mean by that? It's been my experience that all too often, we as humans, and we as Christians even, can fall into the pattern of living that suggests that Christianity, or the basic tenets of Christianity, only apply to the areas of our lives that concern themselves with morality, and then also concern themselves with praying for future outcomes. So we can kind of see our Christian faith as this is kind of the moral area of my life, and then also there's this God that I know I need to pray to help with future outcomes. Does that make sense? For example, we have many, many different areas of our lives. Our lives are complex, and we have countless arenas that we participate in them. We are spouses. A lot of us in here are spouses. We are children with ourselves. We have parents. We have children, we have careers, we have hobbies, and we are church-going Christians. Now, if you're here, you've represented that. So when it comes down to the activity and the day-to-day goings-on of our lives, we might be tempted to believe that Christianity can sort of exist in its own category over here somewhere. And then there's the rest of our lives, and Christianity sort of exists over here. But what's really true, and what I hope to impress upon you today, is that the basic Christian principles have their say in everything that we do. And we don't often see them. But I think it's more helpful if we see them. So, for instance, the basic Christian teaching of sin is that as a result of original sin, this is where the rubber really meets the road for with us, is that the world does not function as it ought to. The world doesn't function in a way that where God created everything and it was good. So I can ask you, as you walk around your lives, does everything feel good? Everything doesn't feel good. There are some things that feel good, but when God created the world, Genesis 1 and 2, he looked at everything and it was good. But that's not the reality that I think we live under because of the doctrine of original sin. So for instance, Paul has a lot to say on this. He expounds upon this in Romans. For sin entered the world through one man, and death through sin, so death was passed on to all men, because all have sinned. So I would ask yourselves, do you feel the implications of large sin in your life? And then I'll ask you, don't answer too quickly, do you see the implications of sin in your children's lives? It's there, and it's helpful for us to see. But then also that, just the world in and of itself does not function as it ought to. Romans 8:22 says, and this is again St. Paul, for we all know that the whole creation has been growing together. I hear that a lot when I hear parents come to me to talk about extracurricular activities. The word groan comes to mind. We're all groaning together. So what I'm suggesting here is that sin, because nothing in our lives is impenetrable against it, has had its say in the realm of athletics. So for example, how does the doctrine of sin affect youth sports and school sports? Does that resonate with anyone? Now, I've said a few things so far. I've said your children will, in all likelihood, not play professionally. I've said that we lived in a performance-based society, which is evidence of your children feeling loads of pressure in areas of their lives where they feel like they have to perform. And paradoxically, I've said that I think they will play better and have more fun the more they enjoy themselves and the basic Christian teachings of the principles of sin. That's where the rubber meets the road here. And I'll say this, by the way, though, that latter can feel like a downer. We don't like to talk about sin. It's not intended to be a downer. It's intended just to be revelatory and as a tool for us to see these dynamics in our lives at work. So how does the doctrine of sin in youth sports, how does the doctrine of sin affect youth in youth sports? It was recently brought to my attention. This is a man named Johan Huizinga, who was a Dutch historian and a sociologist. And in 1938, he wrote a book called Homo Ludens, which is Latin for man the player. And in this book, Huizinga suggests that our lives are not just about work and survival and child rearing, that in all of humanity and all of the history of mankind, there's been this recreational aspect to our lives that's good for us. We can go back to medieval days and find chessboards from when there was no food, everyone was poor, they still had time to play chess. Or we can go back to really being further and further back. Paul talks about athletics in the Bible. So there's always been this kind of realm of athletics that has been sort of the side of this recreational that's good for us, but that we also just kind of fall into. So for example, when you had a child that was a toddler and they started playing peekaboo with you, they're playing. We naturally have this instinct in us to play as human beings, which is a good thing. It's a fun thing. What Huizinga suggests is that play should exist. That feeling that you have when you're goofing off and having fun with people and you're playing, that's the quintessential element of play. And we've sort of lost the plot in terms of the way we look at athletics and play in our modern society. But he wrote this book in 1938 called Homo Ludens, Man the Player, and his basic understanding of humanity is that well-balanced people don't just work and survive. That in everyone there's a desire to play, and we see this in a variety of ways. What I find most helpful for this class is to walk through his parameters for play and what constitutes play. So for instance, this is the criteria for play, according to Huizinga. He says that play is a voluntary and a free activity. Best explained in that play is not a survival mechanism and play is not work. A play occurs when someone engages in a pleasurable activity for fun that has no other purpose, has no other purpose than for itself. As such, there is an aspect of frivolity of play. Play is pure. One feels this in this moment, if you've been looking forward to playing golf and you step onto the first tee, you're like, man, this is exciting. I'm very excited to be here. I'm excited to leave everything else out there and to come here and play golf or play tennis or put on a uniform. We feel that. As such, play exists outside of ordinary life and ordinary time. So play typically has a designated area and an amount of time that confines the activity of play. So when one enters into, say, a game, that world should exist unto itself. There shouldn't be things that we bring into it or take away from it, but it should exist unto itself. So it begins when people put down their tools of work and when necessary survival ends. So it's there's things that kind of go with this. It's childlike and magical. It happens when we say, you know, what kind of fun activity do I want to do today? Oh, I keep saying play golf because that's what I think about in my time. Or go do something fun. So play is in constant, and it has parameters. And this is paramount just to its beauty. It doesn't last forever. We stop playing. We start playing and we stop playing. And that's where really the confines should exist in that area. But when we're not playing, at times it occupies our thoughts. It brings us back to it. It helps us kind of get through to the next thing. So a player is only a player for a short duration during its play. He typically plays and he plays in other kind of partners that he plays with for the sheer joy of it, which occupy themselves. Does that make sense? Okay. Play has rules. Even like when your kids are wrestling, they know like there's these invisible rules that I don't need to take this too far. I don't, when I'm wrestling, I'm not really trying to hurt my sibling. That's a natural kind of human thing. But we take those rules and we add rules to the sports that we play. Otherwise, they would be ungovernable. So the rules must be enforced to protect its precious sanctity. And when those rules are broken, the guilty participant must be removed and then set outside. This is kind of like the penalty box in hockey. Like, you can't just slash people with your stick. You have to go sit in here for a little bit. Or you've been playing too rough with your brother or sister. You need to go sit in time out for a bit and cool off. Or you have been betting on baseball and that's against the rules and you can't play baseball anymore. So play has rules. Which is not to say the magicalness and the best part of play is that it's just for fun. But that doesn't mean it's not competitive. I mean, we're all competitive. I'm competitive. If your 7-year-old wanted to play horse with me right now, I would try to beat them HORSE to nothing. Just the nature of it. We love play. We're competitive, and that's a good thing. Because it's competitive, play is uncertain. We don't know the outcomes of a game. But this is particularly... enlightening because so often our children, I'm talking about this more in a minute, our children come to a game at times and say, I need to play well in this uncertain game or else I am fill in the blank. I'm a loser. I'm a failure. I'm never going to be good at this. All the things that we typically see in our kids. So play is uncertain. It has tension. That's why we love watching football games. It's uncertain. We don't know that Auburn might show up and win yesterday and score 38 points somehow. And we don't know why Ashton Daniels hasn't been playing quarterback all year. And we wonder how this is just all of a sudden comes to mind. So this explains kind of the magical, magnetic allure to play. It's why we watch football. Why we watch all kinds of competitive sports. We don't know who's going to win. It's not like a movie. It's just been scripted. So as such, play has deep ties within community. The Mountain Brook football game or playoffs are happening. We know they're happening right now. They're playing Fort Payne on Saturday. We want Mountain Brook to win because somehow in a realm, like those boys represent people that live in Mountain Brook. It's the same with Vestavia, same with Hewitt Trustful. When I was in high school, I went to Hewitt Trustful. We played a playoff game, first round of the playoffs against Pinson, and like the town came out for it. It was unbelievable. There were like 1,000 people at our high school baseball field, and I was like, "What's going on here?" Because somehow we represent them. There's a guy named Nick Hornby that wrote this really great essay about this. He's a Arsenal soccer fan, which is the English Premier League, and he talks about this dynamic of why. why do I feel bad when my team loses? It's hundreds of miles away. I've got nothing to do with this game, actually, besides somehow these players represent me. And when they lose, somehow I lose, which is crazy to think about that. But that happens with our kids, too. We're so invested in our kids playing. We're like, my kid better play well. I want them to play well because somehow they represent me, which kind of hints at like a lot of the force that comes out onto this. But it's crazy the way that we do that. We see, and Huizinga actually talks about this really well in this book, like in medieval times, it might be a tug-of-war competition against the next village over. And these people are going, like, we want our men to win the tug-of-war competition because somehow that means we're a better village than the village next door, even though it's just a tug-of-war game. This happens in politics, too, by the way. We want our political group to win. We want our man or woman to be the next thing because somehow they represent us. Then also, play is typically beautiful. Play at its core, it's a lot of fun to watch. I love watching sports because it's so much fun. I love watching sports. It's beautiful. Now, I've said that the basic Christian doctrine has had its say in every area of your life and your kids' lives. And I think this is a helpful criteria to look at. Like, this is what I actually do. I agree with Huizinga. I think this is what play should look like. We have seen that sin entered the world through one man and death through sin. So also death was passed on to all men because all of sin. We know that all of creation groans together. I think a helpful side-by-side of Huizinga's criteria for play and what kind of modern youth and school sports can look like. So play is a voluntary and free activity. And we find ourselves in this world where it's a year, it can feel year-round and mandatory. Like if your son wants to play or your daughter wants to play on a team, they should be going to the practices. I'm not saying that's not true. But the expansiveness to where it's just impenetrated every part of our lives feels very real. It doesn't feel just fun and frivolity. It can feel like a job. Play exists for no other reason than itself. And yet we have so much investment in our kids, hoping that they can play college sports. I mean, I remember feeling that, and I don't mind if my father's listening to this. If my dad's paying for private lessons for me, I remember thinking, this better pay off. Dad's paying a lot of money for me to get pitching lessons. I need to pitch better. Like, that's the whole point. This had a serious crash and burn for me one time. I was in high school. This wasn't dad's thing. This was my high school baseball coach's thing. I was kind of floating at like 86 miles an hour. And the goal was for me to throw 90 because guys that threw 90 would play college baseball. And I went down to this pitching camp in Houston, Texas, in Kingwood. Just me and my coach drove a van down to Houston, and we ate hot dogs the entire way down. And it was like, okay, here's the chance for Will to go from here to here in terms of a baseball recruit, but also to help us win baseball games because we weren't very good at hitting. So it was like, if we're going to play well, Will needs to pitch well. So they kind of another layer of pressure. But I went to this pitching camp in Kingwood, Texas that was going to teach me how to throw harder. It was a velocity camp. And I went from sitting at, we had all these velocity bullpens to see, okay, how are we progressing here? And I was doing this throwing program. I quit football to do this throwing program. And working on it. All right, let's see how hard you're throwing now, Will. First time we went out, I topped out at 76 miles an hour. Well, from 86 to 76. The second time out, I topped out at 75 miles an hour. And I went worse. And I was telling my brother, I have a twin brother. And he was like, hey, how's the pitching thing going? And I was like, you know, I topped out at 75 today. He said, aren't you supposed to be getting better? There's a lot of investment put into Will Fagan. But let's drive down to Texas. Let's get hotel rooms. Let's pay these coaches. Let's do the whole thing. Let's take a picture with a Major League Baseball player with who this worked out for. All right, Will, that's gonna might be you one day because you've shown you have potential because you have good pitches, but we need you to throw harder. And I had a bad senior year. Like, I was like, maybe low-level D1. To playing Division III baseball. So it's like we're going from, here's the standard. Had a bad year, not playing as high as we want to play, and then have a crash and burn experience playing at Birmingham Southern. Not that any of this feels personal to me. This is the way I just see this play out. It's played out in my life. Okay. Play exists outside of ordinary life. So that means that we shouldn't take the results of things and carry it into a math test tomorrow. So this is here. Play exists outside of ordinary life. And yet it dominates our schedules. We plan our lives and our activities around them. And not only that, like, if your kid has a bad game, how often do they care with that 24 hours, 48 hours, until the next time they play? I mean, that was me. If I had a bad pitching performance, I'm gonna feel terrible until next Saturday when I can pitch again, or I'm gonna feel bad for a while. Then it's gonna kind of come anger and then motivate me. But play should not exist outside of ordinary life, which means we shouldn't be bringing these things. We shouldn't be bringing our golf round into a business meeting the next day because we had a chance to shoot 68 and we triple bogeyed 18. Play has rules. I missed this. The rules for the game become kind of rules for life. In order for me to play well, I have to kind of follow these rules and steps outside of my athletic competition and go in. Play is competitive, but a competitive sport has become, like, I must win. I have to win, which is the same as play is uncertain. So we know that when we're going into playing a game, I might lose. Like, we need to have that option on the table for me to actually feel okay about this. And yet, if we do lose, we actually like the world ended. Play has deep ties with the understanding of community. Do we always feel united when we compare ourselves to other parents with, quote, more successful children? I think it shows that's a dynamic at play. And play is typically beautiful. And I would ask, does spending 12 hours on a Saturday at a ball field for a six-year-old something, does that feel beautiful as we're eating Chick-fil-A in our back seat and you find the crumbs on Tuesday morning? So how does the doctrine of sin affect youth and youth sports? Here's where I'll land the plane. Play is clearly supposed to be pure, fun, free. And I think we get glimpses of that. I think we really do. And yet I do believe that we have lived, and we do live, in a culture where childhood sports performance, where it can be argued we become so invested that quite often our children's measure of their identity is how well they perform. I think we see that in different areas of our lives, but for the realm of sports, I think that's true. And as a result, often, I'm not speaking for everyone here, I think this can happen. We measure our own value as parents as how good and invested we are in how well our kids are doing, how well they're playing. There's a personal example that I want to share about my daughter's three-year-old recital. And I was like, I think she does better than this. What are we getting wrong here? And so this can all set us up for one outcome, which is our children need to win. And if they don't win, they need to at least perform well individually. So today we talked about sin, which I think relative to the purity of play supposed to be has crept into its way in sports. I think it probably happened a long time before now, but I think it is very clear that it's here now. Next week, we're going to talk about the law, which I'll explain a little bit about next week, in the gospel, say, in our lives, and how this can help us, and how this can help your kids. But for now, I'll leave you with this. This is a quote by a man named Jeff Ogilvie. Jeff Ogilvie was a professional golfer. He won the 2006 U.S. Open. He's a very thoughtful guy. He's just really, if you ever hear him on a podcast, he's going to say something that's thoughtful and helpful. But he said this late in his career when he wasn't playing so well. This is in 2014. He wasn't playing so well, and he had this to offer. He says, when you're playing bad, you get desperate to play well. And the worse you play, the more you need to play well, which is the ultimate cruelty. I can go into the locker room at almost any tournament and observe the varying levels of stress in players. I play my best golf when I am having fun. But when I'm playing poorly, I have less fun. Yet the best way to play better is to have more fun. Work that one out. Jack Nicklaus once said, don't make golf more important than it really is, which is spot on in my case. I did just that. And the more I've struggled, the more time I have spent thinking about how it all works out. No more, though. I've recognized the fact that the best golfers in the world, who are normally not the ones who play the most, and that they have balance in their lives, and once I have that restored, I'll be back. This game will be fun again, so don't worry, folks. I'll figure it out. That's where we'll end today. I'll be around if you want to talk about this afterwards or things we're out of time. Let me pray for us. Lord, thank you for our kids who are a gift. Thank you for sport, which is a gift. I pray that you would make yourself known to us in the area of childhood and high school athletics. Amen.
You've been listening to audio from the Cathedral Church of the Advent. If you live in Birmingham or find yourself visiting, we hope you'll join us for one of our Sunday services. Find out more at adventbirmingham.org.